To start things off, well, the fall season is well underway already with the opera opening on Friday. More about Rigoletto a little later. And the San Francisco opening last night. This week's opening concerts, Semyon Bychkov is conducting Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. It was last night, tomorrow night, tonight, as well as Saturday night. Also on the program, Wagner's Overture to Tannhäuser and the wonderful Max Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1. I had the good fortune to speak with Pinka Zukerman yesterday at the rehearsal of the San Francisco Symphony. I had a broad-ranging conversation that I think you'll enjoy. A master of the violin and a true humanitarian. I think you'll enjoy this conversation with Pinka Zukerman here on Open Air.
Welcome back to San Francisco.
Pleasure.
So how was rehearsal?
Very good. Enjoyed it.
Your association with the San Francisco Symphony goes back quite a few
long
years.
Long time. 67, I think.
1967.
Maybe 68, but 67, 68 season at any rate.
Wow. Now, I was listening to part of this rehearsal, and this piece comes so naturally to you. Have you lost track of how many times you've done it, or do you have a notch on your belt for every time you do the book?
No, I wish I had 10 cents for each one, though. No, I don't... Apropos, going back to San Francisco beginnings, you know, I played here with Cripps the first time.
Wow.
He was music director at the time at the Opera House. And it was four times I played, I remember. It was, the week. But it was at that time, it was Friday afternoon. And the Friday afternoon concerts were rather unusual because the stage was very high and there were four ladies in the front. And some of them fell asleep in a slow movement. Oh, and the orchestra was really in the first violins were in hysterics. It was very funny. Anyway, I played many times in the Opera House, actually. Played once a recital we did with, a joint recital with Perlman. We came here, and the place was packed, and there were about 2,000 or 3,000 people still waiting for tickets. We could have played at least twice.
Wow.
That night. It was really fantastic. It's been a great city for music, always.
And you've seen this orchestra grow and change, of course, over the years.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And have you done the Bruch under Michael Tilson Thomas or not?
No, I don't think so.
You're in town for these opening concerts of the San Francisco Symphony season, not under MTT, who has some previous engagements that have kept him away, but under the baton of your friend Semyon Bychkov. And who is married, I understand, to one of the most famous, well, one of the most pairs of sister pianists on the books, Marielle Lebec.
Right.
That must make for some fun social music making.
Well, they're terrific. I mean, they're terrific people, wonderful artists. I've been to their place in Paris. I had dinner when I played with Simon there. Oh, I don't know when he was. I think it was music director of the Orchestre Paris. Anyway, we went to dinner afterwards in their house, and it's quite an unusual place. It's two sort of towers, but it's not towers. It's actually combined because the two girls had to practice, right, alone, and meaning separately, and so they had to have separate places. But it's a very old place. It's beautiful, and he's just joined them quite a number of years ago. But they seem to be very happy, which is wonderful.
Here's a story you can share at your next dinner together. You ever play the game 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or 6 degrees of separation?
Right.
Well, here's a way you can bring the Bruch Violin Concerto back to San Francisco. Bruch had sold his original score to the Violin Concerto outright to his publisher, Simrock, but he kept a copy, an autographed copy himself. At the end of World War I, he was destitute and entrusted the score to two sister pianists, Ottilie and Rose Sutro, American-born sisters who were one of the first acclaimed touring duo pianists and for whom he had written his concerto for two pianos in A-flat, Opus 88A, with the hopes that they would sell the work here in the States and get the money back to him. He passed away before that could happen. But back to the Sutro sisters. Now, their uncle was Adolphe Sutro, a former mayor of San Francisco.
Is that right?
Yeah. And founder of the famous, I don't know if you've heard of the Sutro Baths.
Sure.
Or the Sutro Tower.
I had no idea.
The Sutro Tower, that is the highest structure in San Francisco, is actually about 100 yards from the original Adolphe Sutro mansion.
How fantastic is
so
that?
So here's where you can connect.
That's great.
Connect Bruch to Sutro.
That's good. Thank you.
Now, I was listening on part of the rehearsal, And I noticed in the first movement you were directing the violins to add a little bit more what I like to call shovelando in between the
shovelando. Yeah. No, there was one spot. There was one spot that I had forgotten that I did not mark it in my part. I guess I've asked for it, and so therefore I was assumed it was in there because the string parts are mine. I have the wind parts as well, but we don't send that. We usually just send a PDF these days, which is much easier library. So I just asked for them because they're also the cellos, and they seem to enjoy doing it. So that was very nice.
And Maestro Bychkov had to do some fine tuning. It just brings up to the fact that even an orchestra of this caliber, wherever you go, you must see these orchestras that still need a little bit of fine tuning before you go out.
Well, it's not, you know, fine tuning is maybe too strong a word, I think, or maybe if I may use a slightly different sentence, it's really exchanging the thought process of what music is about. Not because they're not doing it, it's because you just want to possibly bring something in to individually to the players as an orchestra. And then you ask for the type of work that we always do as conductors, which is to play together. So it's a little bit of both. I use the metaphor as a car. If you have a good car, you still need to find out what the engine can do. And how do you find out the engine if you don't ask it? Well, the way you ask it with a car is by pushing the RPMs, using the brake, maybe looking to the left and to the right, see what the steering wheel is doing and how it's doing it, to see if the tires have the right amount of air in them, etc. Well, it's the same thing here, really.
So it varies from orchestra or to orchestra in that
way. Yeah, I think the more the orchestra, the better the orchestra, the better the instrument, the more time you want to spend finding out what it can do. And not necessarily by, as a guest, not necessarily by just the rehearsals, but at the concerts as well. The times where there will be some other motions that you create that will bring this kind of an orchestra to a different level, just by the sheer fact that they are seeing something totally different. And they'll go, whoops, what's that? And sometimes you'll get a positive, and sometimes you get a negative, which is fine too. Yeah.
Now, this Bruch Concerto No. 1, G minor, wastes no time plunging headlong into some really dramatic territory, having you dig really deep down into those lower strings and double stops of that. I'm wondering, do you have different instruments that you use based on the concerto you're about to play, or are you always in love with the instrument that you have?
No, in fact, I'm against that completely. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I've seen in auditions where people use, for example, different bows for different, let's call it, periods of music.
Right.
And I go, is that your bow? Oh, no, I just borrowed that to play Mozart. Well, what do you mean? You're going to do that in the orchestra when you, if you're hired? You know, in other words, you have to learn how to do it. A good instrument and a good bow will certainly help. There's no question about that. And it has to fit. By the way, the player, the bow, and the instrument have to fit each other. Sometimes it doesn't. You don't have to change bows. But once you find a match, you stick with it. You don't change in the middle of a movement.
You're playing quite an instrument. You're playing on a 1742 Dushkin Guarnerius del Gesù.
It's the same year that the one Heifetz played, which belongs to the orchestra here.
Wow.
In fact, he made three violins in the same year. One is called the Heifetz, of course, now Dushkin, which I play on, and the Vioto, which is a great, great, great violin as well.
And how long have you had that instrument?
Oof, since 1980.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been very lucky, extremely lucky.
Mm-hmm. The great violinist Josef Joachim, who was a friend of Bruch's, made some suggestions to the composer to make the score more friendly to performers after its initial premiere. I'm wondering, do you know what sort of changes those were?
No. But he did it also with Brahms, don't forget. He's a very good composer, wonderful fiddle player, a very good friend of many great composers at the time. And they all went to him for opinions of what he thought of the violin part and then the orchestration, because he was a wonderful composer. Joachim was terrific. A great musician.
I'm wondering if you've had a similar opportunity to coach or guide a contemporary composer with a new work.
I wouldn't say coach. I would certainly be in dialogue, let's put it that way. Oh, yeah, many. I've talked, but not much. If it's a good one, if it's a good composer, you leave it alone. You just suggest some things. And sometimes they'll go for it, and sometimes they say, no, I'd rather have it this way. So I've done a lot of that. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly with orchestration. sometimes they're not quite aware that I'm not hearing what I want, I'm seeing here. So can we change dynamic or sometimes a different instrument in the orchestration? So that's very important. But again, it's dialogue of the most extreme and high-level communication between people.
Contemporary composers and works come to mind that, you know, that this is going to be 100 years from now, a Bruch violin concerto.
Well, the last time I played here, not in January, but the time before with Michael, I played Oliver Newsom's violin concerto, which is an incredible piece. He was a great composer. So there was a premiere here on the West Coast about 4 years ago, maybe? Something like that. And, definitely, that's already been played a lot. It's been recorded. So that's definitely going to stick there. And there's a viola concerto that Miklos Rózsa actually wrote me, which also has not been played a lot by quite a few viola players, which is wonderful, wonderful piece.
There's got to be an art to programming a concert like this. Did you choose the Bruch?
I did. I asked to play that. Seeing that he was doing Tchaikovsky, I thought that would be a good first half.
Exactly. And so Tchaikovsky 5 is...
Yeah, but it's good that he did. He's doing Wagner before. It's very interesting.
Wagner, Tannhäuser.
Oh, yeah.
Start things off.
It's perfect for that.
So it seems like a very well-rounded program. It just fell into place,
absolutely.
Really. You seem to be continuing the great path of some wonderful instrumentalists or singers. I'm thinking of Perlman. I'm thinking of Domingo, who, having established themselves as world-class soloists, have taken to the podium. Do you suppose that's an analog to the film or TV actor who longs to be a director? I'm wondering if that's a natural progression for you or something that's always interested you.
Well, it's been a natural progression. It came out of total interest when I was a teenager at school. And I was about 16. I thought, I want to see what this orchestra has to offer. Not just playing in it, but standing outside of it and learning the scores. But it comes from chamber music. It comes from a very acute process of listening. And hence it became, when I was in my 20s, it started directing with the violin, and then slowly but surely I picked up that silly thing called the baton. But there's a tremendous amount of knowledge and life experience that goes in to doing it and to doing it properly. If I didn't think I had the physical connection to the orchestra and to the music, I wouldn't do it.
Did your technique come naturally to you? Did you have to study since you were... I mean, you've seen so many conductors in your life. Is it just...
Well, it's a little bit, you know, it's that Sandy Koufax story of when he grabbed the ball too hard and he had no control. His movement actually relaxed once he realized what he was doing. But it's still Sandy Koufax. That DNA was in there. So, right. As a great pitcher. And that's really what it's about. If you have the physical ability, connection of hand-eye coordination, and your body transports something that happens in the score to the musicians... That's it. The rest is knowledge and time used for study, which is I sit on airplanes and study scores and mark the parts, and it's huge.
Yeah.
Huge responsibility, you know.
You're a music director of the National Arts Center Orchestra in Ottawa, with which you've been touring quite extensively, including touring the provinces of Canada, which I imagine is a challenge in itself, and getting
a lot of airplane study time. Nah. You know, I play wherever. You know, if it's a small town or a big town, it doesn't make any difference. It's nice to have a nice hall. But if it doesn't exist, we still have to somehow make sure that the music sounds good. And we do.
Negotiations are underway, I understand, for a major tour of the People's Republic of China.
I see you read the Ottawa Citizen, too?
Well, you've also announced that you're going to step down as music director in 2015.
In 3 years, that's right.
So do you hope to get that... tour under your belt?
Oh, no, that tour is already next season.
Fantastic.
It's in, I think, if it's, I'm not mistaken, it's October 13, 2013. And I've been to China a lot, so this the orchestra is first. And, you know, the orchestra itself it belongs to a federal institution called the National Arts Center. So we are tied, in a way, in a hip to the government. It's government, the NAC, the National Arts Center, is given money by the government. And so, but half the budget is given to us for the whole National Arts Center, not us, the orchestra. The orchestra just sees a percentage of that. And so we still have to fundraise, but it's still a federal orchestra. It's a federal institution that needs to always watch across our shoulder what government is doing.
Sure.
If government says, we'd like you to go now, they make it possible for us to go, but the work is still the same.
I'm hoping that they're not saying, we want you to go now, meaning you're ending your music directorship.
No, not at all. No. I'd really, you know,
is
the
your
idea...
Is time done with the...
I think it's time to... you know, I've been music director for quite a while. It's a good 25 years. It will be more than that between Minnesota and Ottawa, plus some principal guest places that I've been over the years. I just want to be a free bird for a change and really just come and enjoy and not worry about their families or where the next piece of bread, you know, how much money we're going to earn to bring the next. We are in a very, very strange and very complex time right now for the arts generally. And that's universal. It's not just in North America. And I can tell you that the most important thing, above all, is first of all understanding between people, which is going to be difficult. It's going to be very, it's already been very difficult, because change does not come easy to the human being. But change is there. It's not coming, it's there. And so what we need to do is go back to fundamentals, and that is to take our children back to the high schools and the junior highs, bring music back to all these communities. And we have to force the hand of government. And we have to, we literally have to say, look, if this does not happen, we're going to have a desert here. Not only here, many places. So it's a great thing to have a child of a family succeed in music. It's pride. It happened in the late 1800s in France. It happened here after the Second World War of immigrants that came from all over the world. It's now lost its direction to some extent.
I can imagine a lot of the problem is there's so many distractions now for a kid growing up virtually anywhere in the civilized world with electronic distractions.
Well, there are many problems.
So,
but the problems are there to be solved, you know. They're not there to go, oh, my God, it's your fault, it's your fault. No, no. Let's just sit back and look at what's not there anymore. We don't have music education in the schools.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And that's so important. Mm-hmm. That must go. The band music alone on Sundays in Michigan, in all these games, they're not the same as they used to be. They're still there. For example, just that alone. I mean, we have some of the great brass playing in this country because of those programs.
Right, right.
But what's going to happen in 10 years from now?
Yeah, I'm a proud public school graduate of the whole band program and then orchestras and college.
It's not a question of making a living as a musician. It's a question of what you inherit as the person acquiring that information in the school.
And I think for the parents, too, to make, you know, being a soccer mom as important as being a practice your piano mom.
Sure. It should be, but even the parents are not doing it anymore because they didn't have the education already. So it's a spiral down, and with economic downturn, we have now even bigger problems. So we need, as communities, to really look into government. Go to the senators, go to congressmen, write to Washington. We got to create a commission in the country that really, with great thinkers like a Clinton, Obamas, these people need to make the changes.
Right.
And if it doesn't happen, we're going to be in a lot of trouble here. It's not a question of filling bums and seats only.
Yeah. After Ottawa's musical directorship, what's next on your conducting horizon then?
Oh, I'm doing everything.
Yeah.
Sure, everywhere.
And on the solo front?
Same thing. I'm just keep on doing it. It's wonderful. You know, 15, 16 is not yet quite in the books, but it's coming now. So I'm finishing in August of 15, so... Booking for that season will start momentarily.
I know. I've just gotten my calendar for 2013.
It's like,
you have to plan so far ahead.
Yeah,
you must. Absolutely must. Now, I wasn't able to find your release of the Brook Concerto that you recorded with Zubin Mehta on RCA. And with the holiday weekend here and all, I thought I'd just see what I could find locally. And it turns out I found a Sony Classical re-release that had the Wieniawski Second Concerto, some music of Tchaikovsky, along with the Brook performed by Isaac Stern and the Philadelphia Orchestra under Eugene Ormandy, mm-hmm. which we'll hear shortly on the radio. And it turns out you wrote an introduction to the CD series, Lauding Isaac Stern. Can you tell me just a little bit about your association with Isaac Stern?
Whoa. I met Isaac, I was 10, 9 and a half, 10, in Israel.
That's right. Let me just back up one moment. You were born in Israel in 1948.
Right.
The year of Israel's founding.
That's right. Three months after its actual initiation, wow. So to speak, into the wild, wild world.
Yeah.
So
10 years old.
I was about 10, and I played for him. And then when I was 12, he came back again. It was a festival in the summer that he came to all the time. And he brought Eugene Stoneman, of course, was part of the trio, and Leonard Rose, Budapest Quartet were there, members, and Kazas was there, and a whole bunch of other people. So I played for them, and then the deal was that I would come to America to study under the auspices of the America-Israel Cultural Foundation, which, in friendly terms, called AICF. And we used to have a lot of those. We used to have BORAC, KLM, AICF. So, and then I came to America, and I came on my own. I've known Isaac, well, I knew Isaac for 40-some years. And he's a great mentor of mine and a leader of great virtues and standard. And he was one of those people that we need today to bring to the forefront the importance of art, music, culture. He would pick up the phone and call people in Washington and say, what the hell do you think you're doing?
Right, I'm thinking Marilyn Horne along those lines as well.
Marilyn Horne is doing it now. Placido, I'm sure, is doing it.
And I'm sure Michael Tilson Thomas is, too.
I'm sure Michael is doing it. Isaac did it. But, I mean, I remember many times he would phone the mayor of New York. He said, no, this can't go like this. The Carnegie Hall can be that expensive. It's not possible. You know, we can't afford it. You know, you got to do something about it. And he did. He marched right in front. I mean, the whole National Endowment was, he was one of the founders of it with Zell and a whole bunch of people. So he and Lenny Bernstein and Zell and Ormandy and these people were, they believed in talent. They actually, Isaac always said, I love talent because it teaches me how to play better. And it's true. And I do the same thing. It's just generation after generation. You know, it's like a little bit like the shoemaker in Italy or the winemaker in Napa. Teach their son. You know, Mr. Craig has a son that's not making wine, as he has for many years. So it's a generational thing. Just to be around this man and to see what he did and how he did it, to, of course, to eventually play with him for many years, to tour.
Right.
I was awestruck a lot of the times.
So it seems much more than just a musical mentor.
Oh, God, yeah.
So anyway.
Sure. And yeah. The family. In fact, I'm going to play with his son now. He's in Kansas City, Michael. In January, I'm playing the Elgar Concerto with him. So I'm looking forward to that a lot. Because I knew Michael before he was born. It's good, huh? It's funny. Yeah.
Well, I wish you well in not only your San Francisco performances, but in all that you do.
Thank you very, very much.
I understand there's one more thing that keeps you enthusiastic in returning to San Francisco, and that's the food scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, Isaac took me to Swan. That was his favorite place since he was a little boy here, of course. He loved Swan, so I'm hoping to get there sometime.
Any other favorites in the town?
Oh, there's so many restaurants now. My God, it's amazing. Asian fusion is unbelievable. I love that food. It's just a beautiful city. It's incredible. We had two great violinists came from here, Menuhin and Isaac Stern. That's pretty cool.
Well, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
The great violinist, Pekka Zukerman, backstage at Davies Symphony Hall. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe in for Alan Farley with a reminder that this is our first day of our fall membership drive. 800-525-9917 is the number to call. 800-525-9917 to show your support for the station in general and for some cultural programming in particular, if you're so inclined. You can also make that donation at KALW.org. I'll be joined later this hour by John Epperson, who is appearing as Lipsinka in The Passion of the Crawford at the Raz Room. But back to Mr. Zukerman for just a moment. Semyon Bychkov is conducting the first violin concerto with Zukerman as soloist tomorrow evening, as well as Friday and, tonight, Friday and Saturday evening at Davies Hall. Information at sfsymphony.org. On that program, the Overture to Tannhäuser of Richard Wagner, the Brook Violin Concerto, and the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 5. Zukerman had mentioned how much Isaac Stern was a mentor, and I mentioned in the interview that we'd be hearing some of that concerto. Here is the third movement of the Brook Violin Concerto performed by Isaac Stern and the Philadelphia Symphony underneath the baton of Eugene Ormandy. Thank you. The third movement of the Max Bruch Concerto for Violin and Orchestra No. 1 in G minor, Opus 26. We heard Isaac Stern in that performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra under the direction of Eugene Ormandy. It's on a Sony Classical release which bears a dedication from my earlier guest, Pinchas Zukerman, who is appearing for these opening concerts of the San Francisco Symphony's 2012-13 season last night, tonight, Friday, and Saturday, a program with Semyon Bychkov as guest conductor, while Michael Tilson Thomas is on other business. Also on that program, the Overture to Tannhäuser of Richard Wagner and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5. Ticket information and more about the program and their full season at sfsymphony.org. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulipe in for Alan Farley and Open Air, KLW's weekly program of arts and cultural affairs. I'm going to have a guest next in just a moment, John Epperson, who's appearing as Lip Synca at the Raz Room. But I wanted to take just a quick moment out of the programming, not interrupting with these large pledge breaks, but just to ask for your support during this, our fall membership drive. And I'm joined by our station manager, Matt Martin. Hi, Matt.
Good afternoon, David. Today, we are on our first day of this membership campaign, and we're calling it Thank You Thursday, because we're really starting where everything happens at KALW, and that is beginning with the listeners who decide to become members. To the extent that you can, whatever level you come in at, you make a difference here at Local Public Radio. So we're thanking folks all day like Allison Augustin, Richard Best, Rena Branston, Dan and Claire Carlovaro, Judith Davidson, Erica De La Court. Hundreds of people today, actually over 200 people we've been able to thank during this first day of this membership campaign. Be the next person who we thank by making a call at 800-525-9917 or going online to kalw.org. Although I should say, if you'd prefer not to have your name on the air, we will thank you for your support and we appreciate it. But, you know, we do like to thank the folks who make this station go, and those are our listener supporters.
And it's a great way to show your involvement with Local Public Radio. 800-525-9917. It's so wonderful to start this drive on such a strong note. We're going to be easily saying thank you by the end of the day to 333 people, which is our goal. That could be a pledge of a dollar. It could be a pledge for $1,000. Matt, we had a fascinating piece of mail today that came in. Someone had found a $100 bill on the street.
Yeah.
They put it in an envelope and mailed it off to KLW.
Well, because what the listener said was, she said, you know, I didn't like to profit from somebody else's loss. But then I thought, I want to give something back to the community as a whole. And she thought of KALW as a place where she could do that. And a program like Open Air that brings in so many of the voices and musicians and creative talents from around the Bay Area, that's part of KALW's mission. And your support keeps us connected to the community, keeps the station strong, vibrant, diverse. Make a call, 800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org.
Make that pledge now, 800-525-9917. Show your support for the diversity of programming that you hear on KLW. I mean, this hour alone, we just heard from one of the most acclaimed violinists in the world coming to our studios, or actually about my going to him, but nonetheless on our air, talking about everything from the importance of music education. Well, let's talk about the importance of radio education. If you've gained something from KALW, make a pledge now. 800-525-9917 or at kalw.org. Make it now. And we're going to keep our commitment to keeping the programming intact. Open Air has a bit of flexibility, so you're hearing us maybe for a minute more right now. But nonetheless, we're not interrupting. We're not cutting anything out of an otherwise broadcast edition of Open Air. I'm David LaTulipe in for Alan Farley, and in just a moment I'll be talking with John Epperson, appearing as Lip Synca in The Passion of the Crawford at the Raz Room. Stay tuned. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. I'm David Latulipe, and for Alan Farley. It's our weekly program of arts and cultural affairs. Shifting gears a little bit here, we're going to talk with John Epperson, my guest, who is appearing as Lip Sinca in The Passion of the Crawford at the Raz Room here in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi. Why are you shifting gears? What does that mean?
Shifting gears from quiet guitar music and violin virtuoso to a virtuoso of performance. How does that sound?
You had Pinchas Zukerman on earlier, right?
We did.
Yeah.
Indeed.
From the ridiculous to the slime.
we could consider it that. Your words, not mine. Although those are not the words I'd use to describe it, having seen the show last night.
Thank you.
It was really brilliant.
Thank you.
What brought you to Joan Crawford and when?
Oh, gee. Well, I was fascinated by Joan Crawford many years ago, before we ever knew about the book Mommy Dearest. Just, I think, because of the way she looked, I found her face to be fascinating and graphic and beautiful all at the same time.
Right.
And then after she died and her daughter's book came out, then we find out that there's this other side of her that may have existed. That's Christina's version.
Sure. And I imagine the movie Mommy Dearest, the movie version of parts of the film probably assisted in your characterization.
Well, the movie, it just visually expanded what Christina had already put in print and maybe exaggerated it. But I enjoy the movie a lot just because I think Faye Dunaway is so great in it.
Oh, she's brilliant. I've watched it several times, and each time it's just a marvelous characterization. As is yours, you go through quite a bit of... let me set up the premise of the show. It's like extended interview, basically, that's happening on stage. You're not alone on stage. You're directed by Kevin Maloney, and your co-star with this is Steve Halsey, who acts as...
Hasley.
Who acts as the interviewer. Tell us more about the show.
The show originally started in 1998 when Christina wrote another, I guess, unedited version of Mommy Dearest that had material that wasn't in the original publication. And she wanted to sell it online. And a fellow here in San Francisco was working with her. His name was Mark Hustis. And they did an event here, I think, at the Castro Theater. And Christina appeared live. And she wanted to go on the road with the show. And so he contacted me, because he knows I live in New York. And he said, we're going to do this event at Town Hall. And Joan Crawford did a famous recording of an interview at Town Hall in 1973. Would you be interested in recreating a part of that interview? And Christina will be there too, and Rex Reed is going to interview her, and we're going to show the movie Mommy Dearest. And so I put together an 18-minute version of the show for that event.
Now, hearing it, seeing you on stage, you created the interview from just audio? Or did you actually see a filmed version of some of the audio that we're hearing?
The interview that I recreate was only audio.
Wow.
It was not filmed, because Town Hall is a union house, and if they filmed it, they would have had to pay how many more thousands of dollars to bring a camera in.
Uh-huh.
Which is one of the reasons she's so nervous at the beginning of the interview, because she was not accustomed to appearing in front of a live audience unless there was also a camera. She was really only comfortable in front of a camera, which is one of the fascinating things about her.
That's interesting. You're playing the audio and you're lip-syncing to her words, as is Steve.
Steve is lip-syncing to the interviewer.
To the interviewer. And yet there's also audience reaction involved, too. Now, I'm wondering if the recorded audience reaction, does that ever interfere with the live audio, interaction with the audience?
It doesn't interfere, per se, but I use that applause and laughter as a cue for myself to acknowledge the audience, even though it's canned, you know. I acknowledge the real audience, and then they laugh because it starts to take on all these surreal layers of what's real and what isn't. Is it live or is it Memorex?
Right, right. There's a wonderful sequence that's memorable from the Mommy Dearest film that I recall rather vividly, and that's the Christmas interview where Joan is being interviewed by, I've forgotten the name of the famous radio personality at that time.
George Fisher or something like that.
In the Crawford home next to the Christmas tree.
Right.
And she talks about how they give away their gifts or something, and it just was a wonderful excerpt.
Well, they do recreate that interview in the movie Mommy Dearest, but that is also available on record, and we recreate a bit of it, the original, in the show. There's Christmas flashbacks, we call them.
You also do have a marvelous scene of cutaways from multiple movies where there's a phone ringing. The phone sequences must have been a lot of fun to put together.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen any other Lip Synca shows, but the phone, answering the imaginary phones is a scene that I do in every show, and everyone remembers it. And you were there last night, and when the phone started ringing, you heard people started applauding because they expected me to do that. But it is fun to do. It was fun to put together, and it's fun to do.
You also included an excerpt that was an audio excerpt of her reading from Alice in Wonderland. I had no idea.
It's not from Alice in Wonderland. It's about Alice in Wonderland. It was an appearance she did on the Hollywood Palace. Remember that TV show in the 60s, the Hollywood Palace? And they'd have a different host each week. And someone wrote a dramatic monologue for her about Alice in Wonderland and Little Boy Blue, and that's what that's about. And it's so cheesy, you know, she's dead serious, but the audience is laughing because she is so serious.
Tell me a little bit about your preparation for the role.
Well, if you mean the daily preparation about putting the makeup on and all of that, I have to get there about 2.5 hours before the show starts, just so I can do it at my leisure.
Right.
And I put the makeup on, but I don't really feel it all comes together until the wig goes on my head.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, my preparation was just watching her in other interviews. She did do an interview with David Frost that is on YouTube now. And I studied that, the way she smiles and the way she shrugs her shoulders. She didn't have mannerisms the way Betty Davis did that were big, but she does have mannerisms.
Now, speaking of Betty Davis, a lot has been written and some of it apocryphal, I'm sure, about their relationship and their antagonistic relationship. What did you learn about the Betty Davis Joan Crawford dynamic?
Well, there was some animosity between the two of them. But I think there was some respect, too. They were professionals. And in many ways, they were sisters under the skin. I think one of the reasons they differed was ideologically. Betty was a rebel, and Joan Crawford was a corporate gal. She liked the corporate atmosphere. She was very comfortable at MGM. And then after MGM, she was very comfortable at Warner Brothers. And then after that, she was at Columbia. She had a contract with all these places. And then she was at Pepsi, which was a big corporation.
Right, right.
Betty Davis was at Warner Brothers early on and fought with Jack Warner all the time.
Huh.
She couldn't wait to get out of there. And then she was on her own. And she never really had a long-term contract with any other company, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine Betty, well, we know Betty was a liberal Democrat, and I believe Joan, being kind of an uber capitalist, was on the other side of the fence.
Right, right. And later in life, they appeared together in films.
They did. They did Whatever Happened to Baby Jane,
right,
together, which is coming out on Blu-ray,
oh, really?
I think, next month. And when it came out on a special edition of DVD a few years ago, Charles Bush and I did the commentary that you listen to while you're watching the movie, if you want to listen to it. And so they've put that commentary now on the Blu-ray.
Oh,
again.
Great, great. What fun. Well, I'm wondering if you heard this. It's got to be it's so bitter. I can't believe it's a true story that when Betty Davis was asked to comment on the death of Joan Crawford, she supposedly said, I think it's apocryphal, she said, "Well, my mother said I should only speak good of the dead. Joan's dead. Good."
I've heard that before.
Yeah,
it's hard to know if it's true or not, but It may be.
Yeah. Well, the Razz Room performances are happening as we speak, now through September 16th, I believe.
Yes, and on the 17th, I'm doing, for one night only, Monday the 17th, a show called John Epperson, An Evening with Lip Syncas Made, in which I appear as myself, and I play the piano. And people don't know that I can, but I can.
You're an acclaimed pianist, yes. I used to accompany for ballet.
American Ballet Theater,
right,
yes.
Fantastic.
The whole time Baryshnikov was the director. And I appear in the movie Black Swan as Natalie Portman's rehearsal pianist. Did
I
you know
did
that?
I did not know
I'm
that.
I'm the pianist who walks out on Natalie Portman in Black Swan.
That's marvelous.
So I will play the piano in the show, and I will sing. People don't know that I can sing. And I'll tell anecdotes about growing up in Mississippi and working at American Ballet Theater. And there's even some lip-syncing in the show.
Well, you know, I was kind of like wondering what listeners might have thought. What do you mean you're having a lip-syncer on radio? It's kind of like having a mime on radio. What is it going to do? So it's nice to hear some other projects that you're involved in. What besides, what happens after The Passion of the Crawford?
I'm going back to New York. And I'm going to be working a little bit at American Ballet Theater. I still work there on a part-time basis.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the 30th anniversary of the creation of Lipsynca. 2012 is
30 years. Do you get confused? You get gender confusion? You've been doing this so long?
No. Gender confusion, I've never had that trouble, fortunately. But we're talking to a place in New York about doing a little run there to end the year, which would be nice.
Well, let's see if we can find the correct cue here on the CD you brought of part of the excerpt. Well, it's kind of like rolling the die because we don't have a guide to the tracks. But if you want me to cut it off, just say the word and we'll try another track. Here's an excerpt from the show, yes?
Yes.
All right. John Epperson as Lipsynca and as Joan Crawford.
You were considered a loving mother but a stern disciplinarian. Do you feel you would have done it the same way if you were raising children now?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think this is merely my opinion. I believe that the reason most of the kids are on pot and other junk is because they don't have enough love or discipline at home.
Tell us about your life as a businesswoman, an executive of Pepsi-Cola. Is it an extension of the life of Joan Crawford movie star, or is it something else?
Well, I sold Joan Crawford for so long, all I have to do now is let Joan Crawford sell Pepsi-Cola.
I'd like to add that one of the best ways to know how Joan Crawford lives and what she feels about life and beauty and all kinds of things is to read her very good book, My Way of Life, which was published last year by Simon & Schuster. And on that note, I think we should turn the meeting over to questions from the audience.
And that's a brief excerpt from the actual voice of Joan Crawford being recreated on the stage of the Razz Room at the Nikko Hotel, Hotel Nikko, now through September 16th in a show called The Passion of the Crawford. John Epperson with me here in the KLW studios. That's great. You must have had such fun choosing the excerpts to be used in this show.
Well, it's fun to watch her cause... her concentration is really something. If you see her in the movies, she had huge eyes, you know, and maybe she wasn't a deep actress the way Bette Davis was, but she certainly was a concentrated actress. You have to give her that, and that the longevity of her career. I mean, she made, 70 films, I think, and survived and thrived for so long in that industry. When some people disappear after 5 or 6 years, you know?
Sure. I have to compliment you, especially on your facial expression. And you have these rubber lips that are just amazing. I mean, you can hear every word, so to speak, that Joan is speaking. You're channeling her quite well.
Well, if you're going to call yourself Lipsynca, you better be good at lip syncing.
that's for sure. Information about John Epperson and the Passion of the Crawford is at therazroom.com. Remember that Raz has two R's and two Z's, so the R-R-A-Z-Z room.com. Now through this September 16th, tickets at therazroom.com. John Epperson. I have to say one other thing. You are also the second guest in as many weeks that I have interviewed that has appeared in a New York City department store window, if you can believe that. And if your bio is to believe. Last week I talked with Ira Glass, who was here promoting his film Sleepwalk With Me that he's doing with Mike Birbiglia.
Yes.
And Ira appeared in, I forget which store window, but it was a display of Sigmund Freud's office in Vienna. And the interviewer was David Rakoff. And Ira appeared on the couch for, you know, a couple hours for part of the holiday scene for a window. Tell us about your window experience.
Well, first of all, David Rakoff just passed away.
He did.
Are you aware of that?
Yeah, it's very sad.
And I knew David, and it is sad. It's very sad. Mm-hmm. I didn't know him well, but I'm close with some people who did know him. Mm-hmm. I appeared in the window at Bergdorf Goodman just about a year ago today. I think it was September 8th. Uh-huh. And it was Fashion's Night Out. You know what Fashion's Night Out is?
Yes. Yeah.
And great tonight generator. Is Fashion's Night Out here in San Francisco
and
New York.
Oh. And I don't suppose you have a website we can plug for that, do you? For the Fashion's Night Out?
I don't, no.
To check that out, get it back to you.
But I think people should come to the Raz Room and see my fashion.
Absolutely. Brilliantly chosen, I might add.
So Bergdorf Goodman had done this window performance 2 years ago for the first time, and it was a success, and so they decided to do it again last year, and they asked me to be a part of that, and so I did, and I appeared in the window three times, and there were huge crowds of fashion fans waiting to see this. It was a lot of fun. It was great fun. And Ronnie Spector was also in the window.
Oh, wow.
You know who Ronnie Spector is?
Yeah, yeah. So I'll leave it to the listeners to Google Fashion's Night Out, but you can go to therazroom.com once again to learn more about John Epperson and his show, The Passion of the Crawford. John, thanks for taking some time with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And
thank
I wish you.
You
a spectacular run.
Thank you.
Just another mention of some opera that's happening here in San Francisco. The opera season gets underway this Friday with Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi and throughout September. Information at sfopera.com. Also, opera is going to be in Golden Gate Park this Sunday at 1:30, an open-air setting. That'll be some highlights for the entire season of the San Francisco Opera. You can find out more at sfopera.com. That Sunday performance is at 1:30. And then don't forget the free simulcast of Rigoletto at AT&T Park. That'll be Saturday, September 15th at 8 o'clock. Some great opera for you. And, of course, the San Francisco Symphony underway with Semyon Bychkov and Pinka Zuckerman. Information at sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe. Pleasure sitting in for Alan Farley. And Open Air, we'll catch you next week. Matt Martin joins me once again here in studio during this, our first day of our fall membership drive. Hi again, Matt.
Hello, David. We are having a great first day of the membership campaign. Many people to thank on this day that we're calling Thank You Thursday, and we would love to thank you. Make a call right now before we go to the BBC News Hour, keeping the programming uninterrupted during this campaign, 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or online at kalw.org.
And thanking people today, our aim is to thank 333 people before the day is out to get this drive on a strong start. Thanking people like Meredith Tennant of San Francisco, as well as Ed Chiera of bulliness. Make that pledge, 800-525-9917. It is our fall no interruption pledge drive. We know that's what you appreciate it. And the good news is we're only going to come to you again back in May of next year. We're going to keep it to two drives this year, but it's because of your support. 800-525-9917.
Thank you for keeping these breaks short. You do it because by coming through in the 60 and 90 second minute pitches when we ask for your support, that makes it possible for us to bring you the programming, not only in the sense of everything in the station happens because of listeners, but also just day in and day out to bring you BBC's NewsHour, to bring you All Things Considered from NPR, to bring you Cross Currents from KLW News in their entirety. Your support makes it happen. Be the next person to be thanked at 800-525-9917.
You can also make that pledge at kalw.org. Headlines from London next as we go to the BBC NewsHour, uninterrupted by Pitch Pledge. All for you, thanks to your support.